Hello and welcome to Subrogation and the 2014 Polar Vortex, Recovery Opportunities and Hurdles, a webinar presented by Cozen O'Connor. The webinar will run for 60 minutes. Before we begin, we have a few housekeeping items to review with you. All participants are in listen-only mode. This means that you can hear the speakers, but no one is able to hear you. If you have any technical issues, you can send a chat message via the chat pod in the web room to tech support or press star zero on your telephone keypad if you are on the phone, or call the provider's help desk at 1-877-297-2901 for assistance. If time allows, we will have a question and answer session after the presentation. Please feel free to send in your questions at any time during the webinar by using the chat pod in the lower left corner of your screen and click on the send button. Today, three attorneys from Cozen O'Connor's Subrogation and Recovery Department will be presenting the webinar. Our first presenter is Steve Halbison, a member of Cozen O'Connor, resident in the firm's Dallas office. Joining Steve today are Mark Opoliski and Mark Utke, members resident in the Philadelphia office. I will now turn the presentation over to our first presenter, Steve. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This is our inaugural webinar for our subrogation department. I am going to be speaking on some of the basic facts of freeze losses, as well as the science behind the freeze losses. After I finish my presentation, Mark Opoliski will be talking about some of the subrogation considerations with respect to freeze losses, and then Mark Utke will be following up with impacts of tariffs, statutes of repose, and some legal issues as they may impact your freeze loss claims. This first slide kind of summarizes how this winter has gone. This has been a tremendous winter storm season for mostly the Midwest, upper Midwest, and the northeastern states. A couple of years ago, there was a significant freeze event in the south central region of the United States, in Texas, New Mexico, and southern Arizona. But most of it this year has been focused on the Midwest and the northeastern states. Some basic pipe burst facts. Over the past decade, freeze loss claims have resulted in total claims in excess of $4 billion. That is a small number compared to the impact of hurricanes over the past few decades, but it is still a major expense for the insurance industry. The problem with freeze claims is most acute in the southern states, where, as you would expect, the construction techniques employed by general contractors does not really take into consideration the likelihood of freeze events. So the builders typically employ construction practices that are inadequate to protect water pipes and to protect sprinkler pipes. One of the things that it would be interesting is that the pipe diameter itself is not a relevant consideration to freeze losses. It doesn't matter if it's a half inch, three quarter inch, 3/8 inch, or 1 inch thick pipe. The composition of the pipes, however, does impact the freeze potential slightly. Copper pipes are probably more at risk than PVC pipes, simply because PVC has different thermal qualities than copper. PVC tends to be more resistant to thermal change than copper. Oddly, water lines that burst are more frequently hot water lines than the cold water lines. There have been extensive studies by the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the explanation for why hot water lines burst more frequently than cold water lines is really unclear. The there is simply no data that will explain this that is consensus in the industry. What we do know is that convective heat loss, in other words, wind chill, will have a significant impact on the freezing of uninsulated pipes. So when you have an air gap in the exterior of a home where a pipe comes through the wall into a pipe bid for an external faucet or spigot, that can increase the likelihood of a freeze loss. Similarly, if there's a draft in the area where an exposed pipe is located, that can increase the likelihood of a freeze claim. So the science behind the freeze claims is that it's fairly simple. When water transitions to ice, the water expands roughly 9 to 10% when it freezes. So unlike most people's expectations, and the actual reason for the pipe bursting is not the actual expansion of the ice against the pipe itself. The expansion actually increases the water pressure in the plumbing lines. So typically, the expanded ice does not cause the pipe to burst. It's the pressure of the unfrozen water between what is essentially an ice plug and the closed faucet itself is where the burst event will take place. The interesting thing is, as the freeze occurs, you have the water which is in the pipe is typically going to be warmer than the external air in the frozen environment. And heat transfer, the warm water, the heat from that water will then move through the pipe into the colder environment. And that heat transfer always goes from warm to cold. So what happens is when you put a pipe in a freezing environment or where it's exposed to a super cold environment, you have a supercooling effect where the water itself will go below the freezing temperatures, 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees centigrade. And it can be at that temperature below freezing for an extended period of time before actual ice forms in the pipe, in the water itself. The water will then transition into what's called dendritic ice, which is essentially like snowflakes within the ice. It is essentially a lattice work of ice formation, and then that will eventually transition into what is called annular ice formation. And annular ice is the type of ice we have in our freezers, which is a solid block of ice. So what happens with the freeze event is the annular ice will essentially cause a plug. As the ice continues to grow between the plug and the end of the line where the spigot may be, that expansion causes, that 9% expansion causes the water pressure in that space to dramatically increase, and ultimately the pressure will cause the pipe to fail. An example of this, and I've actually tried this, believe it or not, is if you take two plastic water bottles, like an Evian bottle or an Aquafina bottle, you take a sip from each of them. You close the first one really tightly so that air cannot escape. You take a second bottle, take a sip from that, close it, but don't seal it. Just close it loosely. Throw those into the freezer, or if you're outside in Vermont or wherever, put it outside for a while, and what you'll find is the bottle with the tightly capped top will typically burst. The one that does not have the cap on tightly will not. And that is an example of why we have, that's how we have the difference between pressure and non-pressure. The pressure from the water in the first bottle cannot escape, and as a result, it escapes through the plastic. It bursts the plastic. Then the pressure releases. The pressure on the second bottle can release by virtue of the fact that it can go through the top and then you don't have the bursting event. freezing typically occurs in pipes when the water is stationary and less likely when the water is flowing. That's why we have these examples where whenever there's a freeze event coming up, they always tell you to leave your water dripping. There's no need for the water to be flowing. Some people used to think that a pencil thickness in the water line would need to be flowing through the pipe in order to prevent a freeze event from occurring. That's not true. All it needs is a slow drip to relieve the pressure within the pipe. And this typically will reduce the likelihood of a freeze event in a plumbing pipe. This is an example of this winter. I saw this. It was a comic that I saw in the Dallas Morning News, and it basically just had outside, which is stark white, everything's covered in snow, and inside is just black because there's no power and no light. So why do we have freeze damage? It's pretty simple. It's the lack of adequate heat. So even without construction defects, oftentimes property owners are the responsible parties for causing a freeze loss to occur. Sometimes people turn the heat down to save money and portions of the house get super cooled where the pipes are exposed to the external temperatures. Vacation homes and unoccupied buildings are particularly susceptible. For example, in our Colorado office, regularly they see these vacation homes up in the mountain areas in Vail and Aspen with significant pipe freeze events because they are not occupied and the owners are unable to control the heating and the temperature of the home. So they're only as good as the temperature control systems within those homes. In some instances, some owners seal off portions of the house and they heat certain portions and they leave the other portions cool. If you have water pipes or sprinkler pipes running through those areas, then you may have increased risk of a freeze event. So when the climate controlled space is too cold, the unheated spaces in the walls and attics are at greater risk. You're obviously going to have your greatest risk in your attic spaces, which are not climate controlled, and your exterior walls, which are in close proximity to the external temperatures that are frozen. Other causes, in addition to lack of heating, you could have an HVAC system malfunction. Either the system itself fails, or for an extended period of time, or you have a thermostat or controller failure. The key is time. I mean, if the HVAC system is in failure for a few hours, that's typically not going to give rise to a freeze event or a pipe burst. However, when you have an extended period of time where you have a lack of heat in a structure for 2 or 3 days, now you're talking about a much more extended risk for a freeze event. In addition to failures of systems within the structures, failure of the utility companies to deliver power to enable the heating systems to work is a significant cause. For example, in 2011, there was a significant freeze event over the Super Bowl weekend when it was in Dallas, where there were many power plants that went offline because they did not have freeze protection actually at the power plants, and then they could not deliver power to a significant area in the El Paso region and also in the Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Taos region of New Mexico. There was an extended failure of the natural gas system where a pipeline went down, and that also impacted Arizona. And so when you have these extended lack of utility service, you can have significant widespread freeze losses. What Mark Utke will be talking about with you later on today is these claims are quite challenging because of various tariffs that are published by the utility companies that are largely enforced by the courts. In addition to a widespread loss of utility power, whether it be natural gas or electric heating or oil, you have construction defects that can cause significant risk of freeze losses. So one of the things that you have to consider are statutes of repose. I am assuming for the most part that many of, if not most of the participants today are aware of what a statute of repose is. It essentially is an absolute cutoff of a claim that starts to run from the date typically that the construction of the property was substantially completed. So most of the states in the United States have 10-year statutes of repose. Some are as short as 3 years, some are five, and then somewhere in between. So you have to look at the age of the structure in order to determine whether or not a claim can be made arising out of the original construction and design of the property. So what gives rise to these construction defects, and how can this impact your risk of freeze losses? One of them is the poor placement of plumbing pipes. This is going to be governed by codes. Whether it's a plumbing pipe, it'll be governed by the Uniform Plumbing Code. There's also a Uniform Mechanical Code. There are different codes in different jurisdictions that will apply, but generally they say the same basic thing. The Uniform Plumbing Code says that no water, soil, or waste pipe shall be installed or permitted outside of a building or in an exterior wall unless, where necessary, adequate provision is made to protect such pipe from freezing. Same basic thing holds true with sprinkler pipes, as we'll see in a moment. So the NFPA has requirements for sprinkler pipes, and it says a wet pipe system shall be used where piping is installed in areas that can be maintained reasonably or reliably above 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Obviously, 40 degrees Fahrenheit is a significant amount above the freezing temperature because they want to give some leeway in the event that there are, you know, if you set the standard too close to freezing, then you're going to have too many freeze losses. But the whole idea is you want to put these pipes, whether it be a sprinkler pipe that's wet or a plumbing line, you want to install them in places where you don't expect them to go below 40 degrees.
Steve, can I ask a question of you? Can you make a claim against an architect or an engineer if they design a building where they didn't include that or didn't specify such placement?
That's a good question, Mark, and thanks. You can make a claim against an architect. They are challenging in that you have to look at the plans and specifications and details that the architect prepared. If the plans and details are misleading or incorrect regarding insulation, the layering of insulation, the location of insulation, then a claim could be made against the architect or design professional who prepared those drawings. Alternatively, if the architect has agreed to with the owner to provide construction administration services, the architect may have a duty to identify the contractors or the subcontractors' deviation from the plans and specifications while the architect makes his periodic visits to the subject property. So the claims against architects are going to be defined by the scope of the architect's job, whether they have construction administration services, and whether their plans and specifications are clear and correct. So going back to the sprinkler issues is if the heat cannot be reliably maintained above 40 degrees Fahrenheit, typically wet pipe systems are not the right choice. In that situation, you need to look at other potential systems. Dry systems are one potential solution for environments where the freezing temperatures cannot be avoided. Another potential solution could be what's called heat trace or heat tape, which can be installed on the pipes to prevent freezing from occurring. That can be done on both plumbing lines and sprinkler lines. But we want to make sure that the heat tape and the heat trace can also pose potential risk of fire if it's installed incorrectly. So dry systems can also present a risk of freezing if they are not designed or installed correctly. For example, the improper draining of a dry pipe system during testing can result in water in the system And if there's enough water in the system, you could have a freezing event, expansion of the ice, and then increased air pressure, which causes the sprinkler pipe to fail. Typically, in a dry system, you're going to have a plug of ice, and then between the sprinkler head and that plug, which is kind of like the difference between, it's kind of like the difference it like between a plug and a faucet, instead of having water pressure that causes the pipe to burst, you have air pressure in a dry system. So,
Steve, can I interrupt you for a minute?
You may.
The question regarding the sprinkler systems, can antifreeze prevent a sprinkler system from freezing?
They can. There are two different types of antifreeze systems that are permitted. In 2011 and 2012, the NFPA, which is the National Fire Prevention or Protection Association, issued what's called a TIA, a tentative interim amendment, which allowed the use of antifreeze in wet pipe sprinkler systems. So the two different types of antifreezes that are used are glycerin systems and propylene glycol systems. There are maximum concentrations that the NFPA permits. Glycerin systems, I think, are only 48% by weight or by volume, and then propylene glycol are 38% by volume. So if you exceed those percentages, then you introduce a whole new risk, not of freezing, but of fire, because when the system is exposed, for example, when the sprinkler system discharges into a fire event, if the concentration of the antifreeze is too high, you can have a fire spread issue caused by the actual antifreeze itself. So the key is in these systems is to make sure that the percentage of the antifreeze is no greater than 48% and 38% in glycerin and propylene glycol systems. And also, it's very important that the systems be annually tested and inspected. And with an antifreeze system, they are tested by taking two samples. They sample the percentage of the antifreeze in the system. If it's within the permissible percentages, the system can remain in use. But if it exceeds the percentages, it has to be drained, and then you have to refill it with a factory premixed solution. Another issue with dry systems, going back to risks, are draining. Again, we have condensation that can be that can result if it's not properly drained. If there are low point drains that allow for testing, and then you essentially open the low point drain, it allows the water to get out of the system, and then you close that back up, and you can re-energize and repressurize the air within the dry system. Slope issues can also be an issue with respect to dry systems, because if the system is not properly sloped, even when you drain it, all the water cannot go out. So you have to make sure that the dry system is sloped and the location of the low point drains are in the right spots. Condensation, as I mentioned, is an issue, and then the annual inspections are critical. In a residential environment, which is fairly rare for a dry pipe system, usually in the larger, more valuable homes, you need to make sure that the systems are inspected by a certified, licensed sprinkler contractor. The challenge with that, however, is a contractor who does an annual inspection can only see what's visually viewable. So in other words, if you have a dry pipe system where it goes into a concealed space, they cannot see the slope of the dry pipe. So you could have a contractor or a sprinkler contractor who does a perfectly adequate and reasonable job of inspecting the system, but he cannot see the slope of the entire system. So there is some risk with dry systems, even if you have an annual inspection. So it's very important to make sure that these systems are designed and sloped correctly. There are also owner inspection requirements. So owners, if they don't hire a contractor to do their annual inspection, or if they don't drain it themselves at certain times, then the owner can actually be responsible for his own damage. With respect to improper and inadequate insulation, it's all about heat transfer. As I mentioned initially, the heat transfer is always going to go from the warm environment, from the area of higher temperature, to a region of cooler temperature. And so what you do with insulation is you're trying to slow the process of heat transfer. And that's all it does. So no matter how much insulation is used, an adequate supply of heat is needed to protect the pipes from freezing. If the pipes are installed in such a way that heat can't reach the pipes, the insulation is worthless. So for example, if you have a sprinkler pipe in an attic and you have bat insulation and blown cellulose insulation between the sheetrock ceiling below the attic, and it piles up, and then you, on top of the insulation, you place the sprinkler pipe, and then on top of the sprinkler pipe, you place the bat insulation, you have a problem because you're not allowing the heat from the warmer interior areas to get to the actual sprinkler pipe. You want to make sure that you allow that heat transfer to go from the warm area to the sprinkler pipe and then prevent the heat transfer to go beyond that into the cooler, colder environment. Too often, builders install insulation between the heat source and the pipes. That can be in both a sprinkler pipe system or a plumbing pipe system. And when that occurs, again, we have the prevention of heat to ever reach the pipes, and then you have the increased risk of bursting. So the way this is typically done, in attics at least, is you tent the insulation over the top of the pipe to allow the heat from the living space below to reach the pipes themselves to slow that heat transfer so that you reduce the risk of freeze damage to the pipes. And what we have here is an example, a diagram courtesy of Case Forensics of how that is done. You have the below you have the air conditioned or the heated interior space, then you have sheetrock, and then you have above that either is going to be a truss or a joist, which will basically provide a support for a sprinkler pipe. On top of that, you will have bat insulation, and on top of that, you can have either an additional layer of bat insulation or you can have blown cellulose insulation. Above this insulation is your cold environment. So what you're trying to do is you're allowing the heat to go through the sheetrock to the pipe. It gets trapped in that little void, and it can't go higher, so the heat does not escape beyond the pipe, and you don't have the exposure of the that heat transfer loss, and then ultimately a freeze potential. So moving forward, Mark Opalisky is going to talk about the subrogation considerations on freeze loss claims. Mark has been with Cozen O'Connor since 1988. I think he, after serving a clerkship with a federal judge down in Dallas, he joined Cozen O'Connor, where he has spent his entire career. I'll leave it to you, Mark.
Great, and Steve, thank you. And I think if I hit the right buttons, everyone can hear me now and can see the next slides. I know we have a question and answer section as part of the webinar, and several people have written asking if they can get copies of the presentation of the PowerPoints, and that's absolutely yes. We will get those out to you when we're done later today. Also, if you have questions, certainly feel free to email those or use the webinar now to send questions. We're hoping to keep this to roughly within an hour, so any questions that we don't get to during the session, I'd be happy to answer by email or by telephone later today. I'm going to talk a little bit about just some of the basic subrogation concepts and considerations in freeze claims. And of course, for most of you, if not all of you, these are concepts that you deal with on almost every daily subrogation claim you get, whether it's fire, explosion, you know, any type of water loss. But I'm going to try to focus on how they relate to freeze claims. In freeze claims, of course, you know, Steve talked a lot about pipes, the pipe freeze-ups, which is a large part of today's presentation, but also keep in mind that these freeze and winter-type claims can also stem from your roof collapses due to snow load and ice load. Of course, pipe freezes, as we talked about, and even things such as you know, trees that become too heavy or laden with snow and ice and then snap off. The concepts, as you can see on the PowerPoint, are, you know, spoliation issues, identification and preservation issues, the use of consultants, notice issues, documenting the scenes, and mold. The next slide you should see before you is an example of a tree that's fallen on a car. And this isn't a canned slide, but unfortunately, this is my car. When I woke up last Wednesday and looked out the window, this is what I saw. And it wasn't the type of thing I wanted to see to get my morning started. And it took about 3 hours with a chainsaw to get my car out. Fortunately, the damage was limited because there was so much snow on top of the car and the tree fell slowly enough. But my Nissan certainly, you know, took a little bit of a beating. And this is an example of, you know, a freeze claim where you have trees that, you know, take on a lot of snow and ice, and then the temperatures drop. And of course, in the Northeast, we were blanketed with several power outages, you know, probably even along the East Coast, because of trees breaking and hitting power lines and knocking power out to a house. The reason I take this picture into consideration is it's the tree that belongs to a neighbor. So again, with some subrogation concepts, you can see, well, if there's notice issues and possibly a neighbor knows that their tree might be old or have potential, you know, to fall, then what duty does a neighbor have in protecting against this type of freeze claim? We also see this with a lot of, you know, power companies, but in those situations, for the most part, you know, the trees that snap and knock down power lines aren't going to lead to a subrogation recovery. Moving on to the spoliation issues, and again, if we're talking with or focusing on a frozen pipe in a house or in a commercial building, you know, quite often homeowners will make the first move to call an emergency repair company to come out and fix their pipes. They have water coming back. Sometimes prior to even calling their insurance company. So a big difference in, for example, your typical fire case as opposed to a house freeze claim is that the homeowner may have the frozen pipe, the broken pipe repaired, you know, prior to even the carrier being put on notice of a property loss. And that brings up several issues, as you can imagine. If the pipe's repaired and you call, you know, a local emergency plumbing company, that they come out, you know, does that company have any duty to preserve the evidence? And I suggest, in large part, they don't, and in fact, probably quite often don't even recognize or realize that there might be, you know, litigation stemming from a frozen pipe. But how often have you seen claims and where it's a pipe freeze, but the homeowner or the commercial property manager has really no idea what specifically caused the freeze-up? Was it a lack of pipe support, where Steve talked about how you have pipes with the improper slope? Was it lack of insulation? Was it the homeowner had the heat turned down too low? And these type of claims, usually by the time, you know, you might get involved, it's sometime after where now the pipe has been repaired, there's a new piece inserted, and you're forced to try to track down the repair company to see if, number one, they still have the broken component, whether it's a T or an elbow or a pipe itself, and also whether the repair company is able to offer any expertise on specifically why that pipe failed. And another issue is that homeowners probably, in large part, don't realize that they may be discarding critical evidence if they have a company come out to repair a broken pipe and they don't take any steps to secure that broken piece. Quite often, a homeowner is going to want to get their, you know, their damages controlled and want to get their carrier out there to help with the repairs and, you know, get their household running again and get the water running without even thinking that there might be, you know, the potential for a claim against an architect, an engineer, you know, the original contractor at some point down the road. So they won't really be thinking about preserving the evidence either. And another situation where you talk about evidence is, you know, was the house heated? You know, how many situations that we have where a homeowner might be away for a period of time and turn their heat down, or even a homeowner's home, but they still have a pipe break, and their natural reaction is to turn the heat up now to try to warm the house. And then if you're looking into the cause of the loss and you casually check the thermostat and see they have the house at 75 degrees, you know, you may assume that that's where it was during the time of the freeze-up, when in fact it could have been a lot lower. Another issue is, again, is there an obligation on the repair company to do anything? And I said, in large part, a repair company might not even think about that. But a question I ask that you give consideration to is, what if the repair company was also the company that did the original installation? And I would suggest that there's quite often a theory that can be developed where, particularly if the original installation of the piping and the bad installation and the heating was done, you know, closer to the time of the loss, within a few years, where you don't have statute of repose issues, I can think of a claim I'm involved in right now where the company had an HVAC system and an air handler, but the air handler was put in the attic by the original contractor when the house was built 3 years earlier. The homeowners then hired a different company to do their yearly maintenance work. And that company came, and because they had not done the original installation of the air handler, they had no reason to know that the heating system in the basement also had a component up in the attic. And the attic was, you know, the type of attic with not a, you know, easy access. You had to actually put a ladder up to get into the small attic space. So there is a situation where the plumbing company that did the emergency repairs or did the maintenance work, there really isn't any argument that they had a duty to do anything more than they did. But if the homeowners had used the original company that installed the heating system just a few years earlier, then you'd have the argument that because that company installed it, they certainly should know where the components are, to where they would have the obligation to ensure that there's antifreeze put into the air handler that's up in the attic, even if it's out of sight. There's also the traditional concerns with, again, trying to identify the cause of the loss and preserving the evidence. I touched a few minutes ago on, you know, quite often the repair company might not keep the broken fitting or T, and the homeowner might not think to keep it. But if you do have the ability to have the component or the broken pipe, such as shown in this slide, you know, a few considerations are that even if there's some evidence that there was a freeze-up that occurred, there still might be an interest or need to want a metallurgical examination to make sure that the pipe was manufactured to proper specifications. Sometimes, especially in commercial applications, you see where a pipe might sustain some damage because it had been, you know, suffered from physical abuse. A forklift happened to hit it, or the moving ladders, and so you have, you know, some physical damage that if you have the pipe itself, you're able to determine, was this purely a loss caused by a freeze-up in a pipe, or was it a loss caused in part by a freeze-up, but also other considerations such as mechanical damage to the piece, an improperly manufactured pipe. Even in this picture, it almost looks as if this split is along a seam in the pipe, and I don't quite know if it is or not, but a metallurgical examination can let you know whether there was a fatigue failure in this pipe, or that it had been suffering from long-term failure to where the freeze-up, you know, led to the final event, but there could be other parties that you need to keep involved. Also, one other issue when you're talking about, you know, identifying and preserving is, particularly in the roof collapse and snow load cases, where, you know, the old saying is, what weighs more, 10 pounds of bricks or 10 pounds of feathers? And you could have, you know, a foot of snow on a roof and nothing happened, or you could have a foot of snow on a roof that now the snow starts to melt to where it becomes ice, and then you have rain, and the snow absorbs the rain. So a roof collapses, you know, and it's only a foot of snow, where the defense is, you know, the roofs just don't collapse with a foot of snow. So that's a situation where, you know, early notice and getting the right consultants and experts is critical, because you don't want to wait, you know, a week or several days to go analyze a roof collapse or a collapse due to a snow load, because in that week's time, you may have a lot of melting, you may have more snow, you may have more ice, and so your expert might, you know, might take the opinion someday that, you know, when I was out there a week later, you know, the snow weighed, you know, 20 pounds per square foot, but to get by a Dauber challenge and the aggressive defense, you really need to show what the snow weight was, and, you know, closer to the time of the collapse. And so in those type of cases, you know, you really need to try to get your consultants out early so they can take comparative measurements and know exactly what the weight was that they're dealing with, as opposed to speculating and trying to extrapolate, you know, during some time down the road. Moving on to consultants, and this is somewhat self-explanatory. Of course, I threw in the gratuitous subrogation counsel, but of course, meteorologists, quite often you'll have someone say, well, how can my pipe have frozen? We've had worse winters in this area the past 10 years than we've had this year. We've had colder temperatures. I never had a pipe issue. And sometimes it just depends on which way the wind is coming from. I can think of a case I had in Connecticut a few years ago where the oven and stove in this house was vented to the outside, but when the contractor did the venting, he did not use a louvered vent, you know, the vent that has the flaps that open and close. He just used an open vent. And so for years, that opening was there and cold air would come into the wall of the house, but never enough to freeze some pipes that ran, you know, directly above where this vent was, until the one year where it just happened that you had a severe wind and dropping temperatures with the wind coming from the northeast, which blew almost directly into this louver. And so that explained, you know, why the pipes froze on this particular year, even though prior years they had colder temperatures. And the other, you know, the other experts involved are, you know, self-explanatory depending on the type of loss, but you want to have, for a freeze-up of a pipe, obviously you want to make sure that the heating system's working, that there's, you know, not a leakage of windows or there's some opening in the house.
Mark, this is Steve. What types of experts are you going to be needing for your snow load cases?
Yeah, in large part, snow load meteorologists to help with the weather data for that time. Structural engineers that can come out and, of course, first you take a look to make sure that the facility itself, the building itself, was designed and built to code, and then they can help with the measurements of the snow load involved. We just had in the area where I live a collapse yesterday of a car garage in which there were, you know, two garages side by side in this smaller development, and the roof collapsed on one. And looking in the paper today, it was, you know, that no one, it was a flat roof. No one had gone out to try to clear the roof of the snow. And of course we had rains and cold weather. And in just in reading that case today, I thought, well, if it was, you know, because it's in my, you know, my area near my hometown, that there's the structural engineer that I know is close to that area that I would suggest getting involved. And also, you know, the local meteorologist, you know, to try to give us data that's accurate for the last few days so we can help measure exactly how much snow, how much ice, how much rain that would have an effect on that particular building. Notice issues, obviously, the one thing that I've had a lot of luck with, I'd say the last year, year and a half, is that with emails, it's so easy now to put somebody on notice within minutes, just with an email. You get a phone call in which they say we had this pipe freeze, and we had, you know, a plumbing company out a week ago, and the plumbing company's name was ABC Plumbing out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You go on a website and find the number for that company. You call and say, hey, I need to email you some information, and within, you know, a few minutes, you can have the email address for the administrator or president or manager of the plumbing company, and it might just be a short email saying, you know, we just had this loss we learned of an hour ago, your company just did work out there a week ago, but it's enough to give them, you know, quick notice without having to go through, you know, the slower way of dictating a letter and then trying to fax the letter or overnight mail it. So I've had a lot of success in just getting notice out by email in a matter of minutes. Of course, I follow that up with a much more detailed letter that addresses the issues, but I think that the use of email to put companies on notice now is something that you all really should take into consideration if you don't do it already. And of course, if we're talking with, you know, governmental entities, there's always notice requirements. You know, quite often you have to let the government know within 90 days, and there's also specific requirements with notice to governmental entities. There's, you know, official forms sometimes, and so you have to make sure you follow that if you have a situation where you think there's, you know, the government's involved in a loss. Now, you know, the last two items are, you know, documenting the scene, and that's, you know, self-explanatory. The one thing is when you document, you know, for example, was the thermostat turned down? Do you have comparative fault issues? In some states like Virginia, if your plaintiff is just 1% at fault, you can't recover anything. In other states, it's a percentage reduction. So that's critical to know which jurisdiction you're in as to how some of these considerations of comparative fault might come into play. And of course, with mold, which is just an element of your damages, you know, that's, again, something that's probably more from the damage and recovery side, but it's certainly a major consideration, because if you have a water loss and, you know, for example, you don't have an environmentalist come out to give your adjusters a chance to ensure that they have the mold issues addressed, then what could be a minor mold problem, you know, could turn into a major problem within a short period of time. And with that, I am going to end my portion of this and turn the conversation over to Mark Dutke, who's also in our Philadelphia office. And I think Steve mentioned Mark started with the firm in the year 2000 after having practiced at another firm for a period of time. So with that, I will turn it over to Mark.
Thanks, Mark. One of the worst winters we've ever had here in the last 20 years is finally coming to an end. And what we've seen is widespread power outages. And one of the statistics that I came across is that on the average, every household in the United States is going to experience approximately 30 minutes of power outage based on some type of weather-related calamity. Steve touched on tariffs, and it's something that we hear a lot about, but the actual primary purpose for a tariff merits explanation. A tariff is really a set of regulations that's used to regulate the actual rates that can be charged by a public utility for energy or gas, and it's a means of providing some type of governmental control so that public utilities don't run afoul with extremely expensive utility rates. Most plaintiff's attorneys will agree that tariffs are really a monumental headache for plaintiffs, because it does afford the utility with an exceptional amount of protection from liability, and liability would only be imposed under very extreme circumstances. Now, the winter of 2014, statistically, has been one of the worst winters in the last 10 years in many areas of the United States. But ironically, in some areas such as Boston and Chicago, this winter doesn't even rank among the top 10 in terms of snowfall. Whereas, for example, in Boston, they've had 53 inches of snow, and that's far less than the record of 107 inches, which they experienced back in 95 and 96. In Philadelphia, just a couple weeks ago, we had a tremendous ice storm which knocked down power lines, and there were more power outages recorded in the Philadelphia suburbs than we experienced during Superstorm Sandy back in October of 2012. And one of the problems is not just restoring power, it's restoring power safely to residents so that a house that is out of power at one point and then becomes energized, that you don't have another liability scenario arising from either a fire or some type of electrocution. And one of the dilemmas we saw in Ohio in January was a widespread gas outage in the Akron area. And one of the problems was not just restoring gas to customers, but it was doing it in a safe manner, because they had to go from house to house, and they actually had to enter each home to restore the gas service so that you didn't have an explosion or a fire event that would obviously entail liability on a public utility.
And Mark, this is Steve. That's especially acute in areas where heating is provided by natural gas. In the south central part of the United States, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, most of that is a natural gas heating as opposed to heating oil, which is more common in the northeastern states.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Just to give you an example of one of the tariff limitation languages that arise. This is actually taken out of a gas company's tariff. And the key language there is that they're not responsible for interruptions in service which are caused by forces beyond the control of the company. So typically weather and weather-related claims, the utilities are going to be insulated from liability under the tariff. Now, there are certain situations when a utility can be held liable, and that's the exception to the rule, and it's when there's willful misconduct or gross negligence. Those are difficult scenarios for a utility to find themselves in. It really is the exception to the rule. There are some standard maintenance requirements that utilities have for servicing overhead power lines and equipment on telephone electrical poles. They have to have an inspection program in place. They have to maintain records of the inspections, and they have to make sure that electricity is being safely delivered to customers. Now, one of the potential causes of action that we are looking at out in the Ohio gas outage that occurred last month was whether or not a utility has a duty to warn homeowners or residents when they are aware that there is going to be a gas outage, that they know that they're in a winter condition, so you're going to have lower temperatures that are going to cause freeze-ups. And is there any duty on behalf of the utility to use either newscasts, flyers, or any type of radio transmission to warn people that if they're going to leave their house, they should either shut off their water, leave a faucet dripping, or somehow monitor the temperature in their home. And the research that we came up with was that the tariff is going to relieve any type of duty for warning customers of this kind of a hazard. Now, in terms of the reason behind a tariff, it's really a balancing act. And if you're going to increase the level of care required by a utility, you're also going to increase their exposure for liability claims, and you'll have to have them increase the rate charge to the public. So in theory, it's the level of care should be commensurate to what the public is willing to pay. And in exchange for that, the utilities do enjoy insulation from claims. Steve had talked about the statute of repose, and it's something that that Mark also touched upon. And there's a difference between a statute of repose and a statute of limitations. And the main difference is that a statute of limitations is triggered by an injury, whereas a statute of repose is triggered by the completion of an act. And an example of that is in construction litigation cases, it's typically the substantial completion of the construction project will trigger the statute of repose. Each jurisdiction has a different statute of repose. For instance, for construction claims, it's very typical that it's a 10-year statute of repose. In other words, that any claim arising from a defect in the construction will simply be extinguished after 10 years from the date of substantial completion.
Mark, this is Steve Halbison. Are there statutes of repose with respect to design professionals as well as contractors?
There are, and it differs by jurisdiction. It's a fact-specific type response to your question. But yes, there are certain time periods within which to file a claim. One of the in construction defect claims, obviously it's the substantial completion of the project triggers the statute of repose from running. For product liability claims, many times a claim may be barred prior to a cause of action arising. In other words, some jurisdictions have a limitation period within which you can file a product liability claim. If a product is over 10 years old in some jurisdictions, it is immune from liability. You simply cannot recover for any type of damage or injury caused by that product. As to warranty claims, typically under the UCC, it's a four-year claim. The UCC provides that the parties can shorten that, but they can't reduce it to less than 1 year. And they would do that by way of contract or some type of agreement between the parties where they agree that a specific warranty is given with a product. Mark had also touched on governmental entities and some of the notice requirements that have to be taken into consideration. Those are strictly construed and strictly enforced by the courts that you have to provide a very specific notification to a governmental entity within a specified period of time. And it's typically done by certified mail. And if you miss the deadline, you could be out of luck with pursuing any type of cause of action against the government entity. The accelerated statute of limitations, that relates back to the contracts that entities may enter into, such as an alarm contract. And typically alarm contracts have fine print on the rear page of the contract, which states that the any cause of action arising from a violation of the agreement has to be pursued within 1 year from the date of the contract.
Mark, thank you. At this point, we have an opportunity for a couple of questions in the question and answer. And one of the questions that was posed is that recent snowfalls have not been in excess of the design loads. However, accumulation over successive snowfalls may eventually in aggregate and exceed the design criteria for snow loading. And the question is to what extent is the owner responsible versus the act of God? That's a great question. And in a multi-family environment where you have, say, an apartment complex and you have multiple snow events where the accumulation of the ice eventually exceeds the design criteria for the structure, you may have an obligation on the part of the owner to clear ice and snow from the roof if they know that there's going to be an additional snow loading. Again, each of these cases would be viewed on the facts of that particular case. It's a case-sensitive inquiry. I'm not aware of any specific code or statutory obligation to clear ice, but that might give rise to a negligence cause of action against the property owner if somebody either was injured by falling snow or if there was damage to a tenant-occupied space.
And I agree. This is Marco Poliski. And particularly if you can show in a commercial facility where the maintenance or management company in prior years had a practice of clearing the snow, you know, whenever it got to be a certain amount of accumulation.
So real quick, a lot of you have asked if the slide presentation or the presentation materials are available. Please note that the slide presentation is available now in the handout section on the screen. And I think that wraps up our question and answer. We've kind of run out of time. And we very much thank you for your time and your participation in today's webinar.
Thank you for joining us today for the webinar, Subrogation and the 2014 Polar Vortex, Recovery Opportunities and Hurdles. We hope that you found today's program to be informative and educational. Please note that Cozen O'Connor Subrogation and Recovery Department will host future webinars discussing claims against foreign manufacturers and pursuing contribution and indemnity claims. Thank you again, and this concludes today's webinar. Goodbye.